energies, fragments of Hypaxamendios's thoughts, shaped from fire. One of them was pie.
"You've no business with the mischief," Hypaxamendios said. "It belongs to me."
"No, father."
"To me."
"I married it, father." The lightning was quieted momentarily, and the god's pulpy eyes narrowed. "It made me remember my purpose," Gentle said. "It made me remember to be a reconciler. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have served you if it weren't for Pi Opa."
"Maybe it loved you once," the many throats replied. "But now I want you to forget it. Put it out of your head forever."
"Why?" In reply came the parent's eternal answer to a child who asks too many questions.
"Because I tell you to,"
the god said. But Gentle wouldn't be hushed so readily. He pressed on. "What does it know, father?"
"Nothing."
"Does it know where Nisi Nirvana comes from? Is that what it knows?" The fire in the Underheld's skull seethed at this.
"Who told you that?"
he raged. There was no purpose served by lying, Gentle thought. "My mother," he said. Every motion in the god's bloated body ceased, even to its cage-battering heart. Only the lightning went on, and the next word came not from the mingled throats, but from the fire itself, three syllables spoken in a lethal voice.
"Sel est in."
"Yes, father."
"She's dead,"
the lightning said. "No, father. I was in her arms a few minutes ago." He lifted his hand, translucent though it was. "She held these fingers. She kissed them. And she told me—"
"I don't want to hear."
"To remind you—"
"Where is she?"
"Of Nisi Nirvana."
"Where is she? Where?
He had been motionless, but now rose up in his fury, lifting his wretched limbs above his head as if to bathe them in his own lightning.
"Where is she?"
he yelled, throats and fire making the demand together.
"I want to see her! I want to see her!"
4. On the stairs below the meditation room, Jude stood up. The Gekagek had begun a guttural complaint that was in its way more distressing than any sound she'd ever heard from them. They were afraid. She saw them sloping away from their places beside the door like dogs in fear of a beating, their spines depressed, their heads flattened. She glanced at the company below, the angels still kneeling beside their wounded maestro, Monday and Hoi Polloi leaving off their vigil at the step and coming back into the candlelight, as though its little ring could preserve them from whatever power was agitating the air.
"Oh, Mama,"
she heard Sartori whisper.
"Yes, child?"
"He's looking for us, Mama."
"I know."
"You can feel it?"
"Yes, child, I can."
"Will you hold me, Mama? Will you hold me?" Where?
The god was howling, and in the arcs above his skull, shreds of his mind's sight appeared. Here was a river, Serpentine, and a city drabber than his metropolis, but all the finer for that, and a certain street, and a certain house. Gentle saw the eye Monday had scrawled on the front door, its pupil beaten out by the Oviat's attack. He saw his own body with Clem beside it, and the stairs, and Jude on the stairs, climbing, and then the room at the top, and the circle in the room, with his brother sitting inside it, and his mother kneeling at the perimeter.
"Sel est in,"
the god said.
"Sel est in."
It wasn't Sartori's voice that uttered these syllables, but it was his lips that moved to shape them. Jude was at the top of the stairs now, and she could see his face clearly. It was still wet with tears, but there was no expression upon it whatsoever. She had never seen features so devoid of feeling. He was a vessel, filling up with another soul.
"Child," Celestine said.
"Get away from him,"
Jude murmured.
Celestine started to rise. "You sound sick, child," she said.
The voice came again, this time a furious denial.
"I am not a child."
"You wanted me to comfort you," Celestine said. "Let me do that."
Sartori's eyes looked up, but it wasn't his sight alone that fixed on her.
"Keep away," he said.
"I want to hold you," Celestine said.
And instead of retreating, she stepped over the boundary of the circle. On the landing, the Gekagek were in terror now, their sly retreat become a dance of panic. They beat their heads against the wall as if to hammer out their brains rather than hear the voice issuing from Sartori, this desperate, monstrous voice that said over and over,
"Keep away! Keep away!"
But Celestine wouldn't be denied. She knelt down again, in front of Sartori. When she spoke, however, it wasn't to the child. It was to the father, to the god who'd taken her into this city of iniquities.
"Let me touch you, love," she said.
"Let me touch you, the way you touched me."
"No!"
Hapaxamendios howled, but his child's limbs refused to rise and ward off the embrace. The denial came again and again, but Celestine ignored it, her arms encircling them both, flesh and occupying spirit in one embrace. This time, when the god unleashed his rejection, it was no longer a word, but a sound, as pitiful as it was terrifying. In the first, Gentle saw the lightning above his father's head congeal into a single blinding flame and go from him like a meteor. In the second, Chigajakin saw the blaze brighten the erasure and fell to his knees on the flinty ground. A signal fire was coming, he thought, to announce the moment of victory. In his Orderex, the goddesses knew better. As the fire broke from the erasure and entered the Second Dominion, the waters around the temple grew quiescent, so as not to draw death down upon them. Every child was hushed, every pool and rivulet stilled. But the fire's malice wasn't meant for them, and the meteor passed over the city, leaving it unharmed, outblazing the comet as it went. With the fire out of sight, Gentle turned back to his father.
"What have you done?" he demanded.
The god's attention lingered in the fifth for a little time, but as Gentle's demand came again, he withdrew his mind from his target and his eyes regained their animation.
"I've sent a fire for the whore," he said.
It was no longer the lightning that spoke, but his many throats.
"Why?"
"Because she tainted you. She made you want love."
"Is that so bad?"
"You can't build cities with love," the god said. "You can't make great works. It's weakness."
"And what about Nisi Nirvana?" Gentle said.
"Is that a weakness too?"
He dropped to his knees and laid his phantom palms on the ground. They had no power here, or else he'd have started digging. Nor could his spirit pierce the ground. The same barrier that sealed him from his father's belly kept him from looking into his dominion's underworld, but he could ask the questions.
"Who spoke the words, father?" he asked.
"Who said Nisi Nirvana?"
"Forget you ever heard those words,"
Hapaxamendios replied.
"The whore is dead. It's over."
In his frustration, Gentle made fists of his hands and beat on the solid ground.
"There's nothing there but me," the many throats went on. "My flesh is everywhere. My flesh is the world, and the world is my flesh."
On the Mount of Lipabayak, Tikraw had given up his triumphal jig and was sitting at the edge of his circle, waiting for the curious to emerge from their houses and come up to question him, when the fire appeared in the fourth. Like Chickajackian, he assumed it was some star of annunciation, sent to mark the victory, and he rose again to hail it. He wasn't alone. There were several people below who'd spotted the blaze over the Jokalelau and were applauding the spectacle as it approached. When it passed overhead, it brought a brief noon to Van Eyff before going on its way. It lit Parashokwa just as brightly, then flew out of the dominion through a fog that had just appeared beyond the city, marking the first passing place between the dominion of green-gold skies and that of blue. Two similar fogs had formed in Clerkenwell, one to the southeast of Gamut Street and the other to the northwest, both marking doorways in the newly reconciled dominion. It was the latter that became blinding now, as the fire sped through it from the fourth. The sight was not unwitnessed. Several revenants were in the vicinity, and though they had no clue as to what this signified, they sensed some calamity and retreated before the radiance, returning to the house to raise the alarm. But they were too sluggish. Before they were halfway back to Gamut Street, the fog divided, and the Unbeheld's fire appeared in the benighted streets of Clerkenwell. Monday saw it first, as he forsook the little comfort of the candlelight and returned to the step. The remnants of Sartori's hordes were raising a cacophony in the darkness outside, but even as he crossed the threshold to ward them off, the darkness became light. From her place on the top stair, Jude saw Celestine lay her lips against her son's and then, with astonishing strength, lift his dead weight up and pitch him out of the circle. Either the impact or the coming fire stirred him, and he began to rise, turning back towards his mother as he did so. He was too late to reclaim his place. The fire had come. The window burst like a glittering cloud, and the blaze filled the room. Jude was flung off her feet, but clutched the banister long enough to see Sartori cover his face against the holocaust as the woman in the circle opened her arms to accept it. Celestine was instantly consumed. But the fire seemed unappeased, and would have spread to burn the house to its foundations had its momentum not been so great. It sped on through the room, demolishing the wall as it went, on, towards the second fog that Clerkenwell boasted tonight.
"What the fuck was that?"
Monday said in the hallway below.
"God," Jude replied, "coming and going."
In the first, Hapexamendios raised his misbegotten head. Even though he didn't need the assembly of sight that gleamed in his skull to see what was happening in his dominion, he had eyes everywhere. Some memory of the body that had once been his sole residence made him turn now, as best he could, and look behind him.
"What is this?" he said.
Gentle couldn't see the fire yet, but he could feel whispers of its approach.
"What is this?"
Apexamendios said again. Without waiting for a reply, he began feverishly to unknit his semblance, something Gentle had both feared and hoped he'd do. Feared because the body from which the fire had been issued would doubtless be its destination, and if it was too quickly undone, the fire would have no target. And hoped because only in that undoing would he have a chance to locate Pi. The barrier around his father's form softened, as the god was distracted by the intricacies of this dismantling, and though Gentle had yet to get a second glimpse of Pi, he turned his thought to entering the body. But for all his perplexity, Hapexamendios was not about to be breached so readily. As Gentle approached, a will too powerful to be denied seized hold of him.
"What is this?"
the god demanded a third time. Hoping he might yet gain a few precious seconds' reprieve, Gentle answered with the truth.
"The Imagicka's a circle," he said.
"A circle?"
"This is your fire, father. This is your fire, coming around again."
Hapexamendios didn't respond with words. He understood instantly the significance of what he'd been told and let his hold on Gentle slip again, in order to turn all his will to the business of unknitting himself. The ungainly body began to unravel, and in its midst, Gentle once again glimpsed Pi. This time the mistiff saw him. Its frail limbs thrashed to clear a way through the turmoil between them, but before Gentle could finally wrest himself from his father's custody, the ground beneath Pai Opar grew unsolid. The mistiff reached up to take hold of some support in the body above, but it was decaying too fast. The ground gaped like a grave, and with one last despairing look in Gentle's direction, the mistiff sank from sight. Gentle raised his head in a howl, but the sound he made was drowned out by that of his father, who, as if in imitation of his child, had also thrown back his head. But his was a din of fury rather than sorrow, as he wrenched and thrashed in his attempts to speed up his unmasking. Behind him, now, the fire. As it came, Gentle thought he saw his mother's face in the blaze, shaped from ashes, her eyes and mouth wide as she returned to meet the god who'd raped, rejected, and finally murdered her. A glimpse, no more, and then the fire was upon its maker, its judgment absolute. Gentle's spirit was gone from the conflagration at a thought, but his father, the world his flesh, the flesh his world, could not escape it. His fetal head broke, and the fire consumed the shards as they flew, its blaze cremating his heart and innards and spreading through his mismatched limbs, burning them away to every last fingertip and toe. The consequence for his city was both instantly felt and calamitous. Every street from one end of the dominion to the other shook as the message of collapse went from the place where its first cause had fallen. Gentle had nothing to fear from this dissolution, but the sight of it appalled him nevertheless. This was his father, and it gave him neither pleasure nor satisfaction to see the body whose child he was now reel and bleed. The imperious towers began to topple, their ornament dropping in rococo rains, their arches forsaking the illusion of stone and falling as flesh. The streets heaved and turned to meet, the houses threw down their bony roofs. Despite the collapse around him, Gentle remained close to the place where his father had been consumed, in the hope that he might yet find Pai Opar in the maelstrom. But it seemed Hepeximendios's last voluntary act had been to deny the lovers their reunion. He'd opened the ground and buried the mistiff in the pit of his decay, sealing it with his will to prevent Gentle from ever finding Pai again. There was nothing left for the reconciler to do but leave the city to its decease, which in due course he did, not taking the route across the dominions, but going back the way the fire had come. As he flew, the sheer enormity of what was underway became apparent. If every living body that had passed a span on earth had been left to putrefy here in the first, the sum of their flesh would not begin to approach that of this city. Nor would this carrion rot into the ground and its decomposition feed a new generation of life. It was the ground. It was the life. With its passing, there would only be putrescence here, decay laid on decay laid on decay, a dominion of filth, polluted until the end of time. Ahead now, the fog that divided the city's outskirts from the fifth. Gentle passed through it, returning gratefully to the modest streets of Clerkenwell. They were drab, of course, after the brilliance of the metropolis he'd left, but he knew the air had the sweetness of summer leaves upon it, even if he couldn't smell that sweetness, and the welcome sound of an engine from Holborn or Gray's Inn Road could be heard as some fleet fellow, knowing the worst was past, got about his business. It was unlikely to be legal work at such an hour, but Gentle wished the driver well, even in his crime. The dominion had been saved for thieves as well as saints. He didn't linger at the passing place, but went as fast as his weary thoughts would drive him, back to number 28 and the wounded body that was still clinging to continuance at the bottom of the stairs. At the top, Jude hadn't waited for the smoke to clear before venturing into the meditation room. Despite a warning shout from Clem, she'd gone up into the murk to find Sartori, hoping that he'd survived. His creatures hadn't. Their corpses were twitching close to the threshold, not struck by the blast, she thought, but laid low by their summoner's decline. She found that summoner easily enough, He was lying close to where Celestine had pitched him, his body arrested in the act of turning towards the circle. It had been his undoing. The fire that had carried his mother to oblivion had seared every part of him. The ashes of his clothes had been fused with his blistered back, his hair singed from his scalp, his face cooked beyond tenderness. But like his brother, lying in ribbons below, he refused to give up life. His fingers clutched the boards, his lips still worked, bearing teeth as bright as a death's head smile. There was even power in his sinews. When his blood-filled eyes saw Jude, he managed to push himself up, until his body rolled over onto its charred spine, and he used his agonies to fuel the hand that clutched at her, dragging her down beside him.
"My mother?"
"She's gone."
There was bafflement on his face.
"Why?"
he said, shudders convulsing him as he spoke.
"She seemed to want it. Why?"
"So that she'd be there when the fire took Hepeximendius," Jude replied.
He shook his head, not comprehending the significance of this.
"How could that be?" he murmured.
"The Imagic is a circle," she said.
He studied her face, attempting to puzzle this out.
"The fire went back to the one who sent it."
Now the sense of what she was telling him dawned. Even in his agony, here was a greater pain.
"He's gone," he said.
She wanted to say, "I hope so," but she kept that sentiment to herself and simply nodded.
"And my mother too?"
Sartori went on. The trembling quieted, so did his voice, which was already frail.
"I'm alone," he said.
The anguish in these last few words was bottomless, and she longed to have some way of comforting him. She was afraid to touch him for fear of causing him still greater discomfort, but perhaps there was more hurt in her not doing so. With the greatest delicacy she laid her hand over his.
"You're not alone," she said. "I'm here."
He didn't acknowledge her solace, perhaps didn't even hear it. His thoughts were elsewhere.
"I should never have touched him," he said softly. "A man shouldn't lay hands on his own brother."
As he squeezed out these words, there was a moan from the bottom of the stairs, followed by a yelp of pure joy from Clem, and then Monday's ecstatic whoops.
"Bossa, bossa, boss!"
"Do you hear that?" Jude said to Sartori.
"Yes."
"I don't think you killed him after all."
A strange tick appeared around his mouth, which after a moment she realized was the shreds of a smile. She took it to be pleasure at Gentle's survival, but its source was more bitter.
"That won't save me now," he said.
His hand, which was laid on his stomach, began to knead the muscles there, its clutches so violent that his body began to spasm. Blood bubbled up between his lips, and he moved his hand to his mouth as if to conceal it. There he seemed to spit his blood into his palm. Then he removed his hand and offered its grisly contents to her.
"Take it," he said,
uncurling his fist. She felt something drop into her hand. She didn't glance at his gift, however, but kept her eyes fixed on his face as he looked away from her, back towards the circle. She realized, even before his gaze had found its resting place, that he was looking away from her for the final time, and she started to call him back. She said his name. She called him love. She said she'd never wanted to desert him, and never would again if he'd only stay. But her words were wasted. As his eyes found the circle, the life went from them. His last sight not of her, but of the place where he'd been made. In her palm, bloody from his belly and throat, lay the blue egg. After a time she got up and went out onto the landing. The place at the bottom of the stairs where Gentle's body had lain was empty. Clem was standing in the candlelight with both tears and a broad smile on his face. He looked up at Jude as she started down the stairs.
"Sartori," he said. "He's dead. What about Celestine?"
"Gone," she said.
"But it's over, isn't it?" Hoi Polloi said. "We're going to live."
"Are we?"
"Yes, we are," said Clem. "Gentle saw Hapexamendios destroyed."
"Where is Gentle?"
"He went outside," Clem said. "He's got enough life in him
for another life."
"For another 20, the lucky bugger,"
came Tay's reply. Reaching the bottom of the stairs, she put her arms around Gentle's protectors, then went out onto the step. Gentle was standing in the middle of the street, wrapped in one of Celestine's sheets. Monday was at his side, and he was leaning on the boy as he stared up at the tree that grew outside number 28. Hapexamendios's fire had charred much of its foliage, leaving the branches naked and blackened. But there was a breeze stirring the leaves that had survived, and after such a long, motionless time, even these shreds of wind were welcome. Final, simple proof that the Imagicka had survived its perils and was once again drawing breath. She hesitated to join him, thinking perhaps he'd prefer to have these moments of meditation uninterrupted. But his gaze came her way after half a minute or so, and though there was only starlight and the last guttering flames in the fretwork above to see him by, the smile was as luminous as ever, and as inviting. She left the step, but as she approached, saw that his smile was slender, and the wounds he'd sustained deeper than cuts.
"I failed," he said.
"The Imagicka's whole," she replied. "That isn't failure."
He looked away from her down the street. The darkness was full of agitation.
"The ghosts are still here," he said. "I swore to them I'd find a way out, and I failed. That was why I went with Pi in the first place, to find Taylor a way out."
"Maybe there isn't one," came a third voice.
Clem had appeared on the doorstep, but it was Tay who spoke.
"I promised you an answer," Gentle said.
"And you found one. The Imagicka's a circle, and there's no way out of it. We just go round and round." "Well, that's not so bad, Gentle. We have what we have."
Gentle lifted his hand from Monday's shoulder and turned away from the tree and from Jude and from the angels on the step. As he hobbled out into the middle of the street, his head bowed, he murmured a reply to Tay too quiet for any but an angel's ear.
"It's not enough," he said.
Chapter 25. 1. For the living occupants of Gamut Street, the days that followed the events of that midsummer were as strange in their way as anything that had gone before. The world that returned to life around them seemed to be totally ignorant of the fact that its existence had hung in the balance, and if it now sensed the least change in its condition, it concealed its suspicion very well. The monsoons and heat waves that had preceded the reconciliation were replaced the next morning with the drizzles and tepid sunshine of an English summer, its moderation the model for public behaviour in subsequent weeks, the eruptions of irrationality which had turned every junction and street corner into a little battleground summarily ceased, the night walkers Monday and Jude had seen watching for revelation no longer strayed out to peer quizzically at the stars. In any city other than London, perhaps the mysteries now present in its streets would have been discovered and celebrated. If such fogs as lingered in Clerkenwell had appeared instead in Rome, the Vatican would have been pronouncing on them within a week. Had they appeared in Mexico City, the poor would have been through them in a shorter time still, desperate for a better life in the world beyond. But England, oh England! It had never had much of a taste for the mystical, and with all but the weakest of its evocators and fate workers murdered by the tabula rasa, there was nobody to begin the labour of freeing minds locked up in dogmas and utilities. The fogs were not entirely ignored, however. the animal life of the city knew something was afoot and came to Clerkenwell to sniff it out. The runaway dogs who'd gathered in the vicinity of Gamut Street when the revenants had come, only to be frightened off by Sartori's horde, now returned, their noses twitching after some piquant scent or other. Cats came too, yowling in the trees at dusk, curious but casual. There were also visitations by bees and birds, who twice in the 3 days following midsummer gathered in the same stupefying numbers as Monday and Jude had witnessed at the retreat. In all these cases, the packs, swarms and flocks disappeared after a time, having discovered the source of the perfumes and poles that had directed them to the district, and gone into the fourth, to have a life under different skies. But if no two-legged traffic passed into the fourth, there was certainly some in the opposite direction. A little over a week after the reconciliation, Tick Raw arrived on the doorstep of number 28, and having introduced himself to Clem and Monday, asked to see the maestro. He came into a house that was a good deal more comfortable than his quarters in Vanier, furnished as it was from a score of recent burglaries by Monday and Clem. But the atmosphere of domesticity was cosmetic. Though the bodies of the Gekagek had been removed and buried, along with their summoner, beneath the long grass in Shivrick Square, though the front door had been mended and the bloodstains mopped up, though the meditation room had been scoured and the stones of the circle individually wrapped in linen and locked away, the house was charged with all that had happened here. The deaths, the love scenes, the reunions and revelations.
"You're living in the middle of a history lesson," Tick Raw said, when he sat himself down beside the bed in which Gentle lay.
The reconciler was healing. But even with his extraordinary powers of recuperation, it would be a lengthy business. He slept 20 hours or more out of every 24, and barely ventured from his mattress when he was awake.
"You look as though you've seen some wars, my friend," Tick Raw said.
"More than I'd like," Gentle replied wearily.
"I sniff something Oviat."
"Gekagek," Gentle said. "Don't worry. They're gone."
"Did they break through during the ceremony?"
"No. It's more complicated than that.
Ask Clem. He'll tell you the whole story."
"No offence to your friends," Tick Raw said, fetching a jar of pickled sausage from his pocket, "but I'd prefer to hear it from you."
"I've thought about it too much as it is," Gentle said. "I don't want to be reminded."
"But we won the day," Tick Raw said. "Doesn't that merit a little celebration?"
"Celebrate with Clem, Tick. I need to sleep."
As you like,"
Tick Raw said, retreating to the door.
"Oh, I wonder, do you mind if I stay here for a few days? There's a number of parties in Vanier who want the grand tour of the fifth, and I volunteer to show them the sights. But as I don't yet know them myself..."
"Be my guest," Gentle said. "And forgive me if I don't brim with bonhomie."
"No apology required," Tick Raw said. "I'll leave you to sleep."
That evening, Tick did as Gentle had suggested, and plied both Clem and Monday with questions until he had the full story.
"So when do I meet the mesmeric Judith?"
he asked, when the tale was told.
"I don't know if you ever will," Clem said. "She didn't come back to the house after we buried Sartori."
"Where is she?"
"Wherever she is," Monday said dolefully, "Hoi Polloi's with her. Just my fucking luck."
"Well, now, listen," Tick Raw said. "I've always had a way with the ladies. I'll make you a deal. If you show me this city inside out, I'll show you a few ladies the same way."
Monday's palm went from his pocket, where it had been stroking the consequence of Hoi Polloi's absence, and seized hold of Tick Raw's hand before it was even extended.
"You're a gentleman and a squalor," Monday said. "You got yourself a tour, mate."
"What about Gentle?" Tick Raw said to Clem. "Is he languishing for want of female company?"
"No, he's just tired. He'll get well."
"Will he?" said Tick Raw. "I'm not so sure. He's got the look of a man who'd be happier dead than alive."
"Don't say that."
"Very well. I didn't say it. But he has, Clement. And we all know it."
The vigour and noise Tick Raw brought into the house only served to emphasize the truth of that observation.
As the days passed and turned to weeks, there was little or no improvement in Gentle's mood. He was, as Tik Raw had said, languishing, and Clem began to feel the way he had during Tay's final decline. A loved one was slipping away, and he could do nothing to prevent it. There weren't even those moments of levity that there'd been with Tay, when good times had been remembered and the pain superseded. Gentle wanted no false comforts, no laughter, no sympathy. He simply wanted to lie in his bed and steadily become as bland as the sheets he lay upon. Sometimes in his sleep, the angels would hear him speaking in tongues, the way Tay had heard him talk before. But it was nonsense that he muttered, reports from a mind that was rambling without map or destination. Tik Raw stayed in the house a month, leaving with Monday at dawn and returning late, having had another day seeing the sights and acquiring the appetites of this new dominion. His sense of wonder was boundless, his capacity for pleasure prodigal. He found he had a taste for eel pie and Elgar, for Speaker's Corner at Sunday noon and the Ripper's Haunts at midnight, for dog races, for jazz, for waistcoats made in Savile Row and women hired behind King's Cross Station. As for Monday, it was clear from the face he wore whenever he returned that the hurt of Hoi Polloi's desertion was being kissed away. When Tik Raw finally announced that it was time to return to the Fourth, the boy was crestfallen.
"Don't worry," Tik told him. "I'll be back, and I won't be alone."
Before he departed, he presented himself at Gentle's bedside with a proposal.
"Come to the Fourth with me," he said. "It's time you saw Patashokwa."
Gentle shook his head.
"But you haven't seen the Merrow TT," Tik protested.
"I know what you're trying to do, Tik," Gentle said, "and I thank you for it. Really, I do. But I don't want to see the Fourth again."
"Well, what do you want to see?"
The answer was simple. "Nothing."
"Oh, now stop this, Gentle," Tik Raw said. "It's getting damn boring. You're behaving as though we lost everything. We didn't."
"I did."
"She'll come back, you'll see."
"Who will?"
"Judith."
Gentle almost laughed at this.
"It's not Judith I've lost," he said.
Tik Raw realized his error then and came as near to dumbfounded as he ever got. All he could manage was,
"Ah!"
For the first time since Tik Raw had appeared at his bedside the month before, Gentle actually looked at his guest.
"Tik," he said, "I'm going to tell you something I've told nobody else."
"What's that?"
"When I was in my father's city,"
he paused as though the will to tell was going from him already, then began again.
"When I was in my father's city, I saw Pai Opa."
"Alive?"
"For a time."
"Oh, jeez you. How did it die?"
"The ground opened up beneath it."
"That's terrible. Terrible."
"Do you see now why it doesn't feel like a victory?"
"Yes, I see." "But Gentle."
"No more persuasions, Tik.
There are such changes in the air. Maybe there are the miracles in the First, the way there are in his Orderex. It's not out of the question."
Gentle studied his tormentor, eyes narrowed.
"The Yurtemics were in the First long before Hapexamendios, remember?"
Tik went on.
"And they worked wonders there. Maybe those times have returned. The land doesn't forget. Men forget. Maestros forget. But the land, never."
He stood up.
"Come with me to a passing place," he said. "Let's look for ourselves. Where's the harm? I'll carry you on my back if your legs don't work."
"That won't be necessary," Gentle said,
and throwing off the sheets, got out of bed. Though the month of August had yet to begin, the early months of summer had been marked by such excesses that the season had burned itself out prematurely, and when Gentle, accompanied by Tik and Clem, stepped out into Gamut Street, he met the first chills of autumn on the step. Clem had found the fog that let onto the First Dominion within 48 hours of the reconciliation, but had not entered it. After all that he'd heard about the state of the Unbeheld's city, he'd had no wish to see its horrors. He led the maestros to the place readily enough, however. It was little more than half a mile from the house, hidden in a cloister behind an empty office building,
a bank of grey fog, no more than twice the height of a man, which rolled upon itself in the shadowed corner of the empty yard. "Let me go first," Clem said to Gentle. "We're still your guardians."
"You've done more than enough," Gentle said. "Stay here. This won't take long."
Clem didn't contradict the instruction, but stepped aside to let the maestros enter the fog. Gentle had passed between dominions many times now, and was used to the brief disorientation that always accompanied such passage. But nothing, not even the abattoir nightmares that had haunted him after the reconciliation, could have prepared him for what was waiting on the other side. Tick, Raw, ever a man of instant responses, vomited as the stench of putrescence came to meet them through the fog, and though he stumbled after Gentle, determined not to leave his friend to face the first alone, he covered his eyes after a single glance. The Dominion was decayed from horizon to horizon. Everywhere rot and more rot, suppurating lakes of it and festering hills. Overhead, in skies Gentle had barely seen as he passed through his father's city, clouds the colour of old bruises half hid two yellowish moons, the light falling on a filth so atrocious the hungriest kite in the Quem would have starved rather than feed here.
"This was the city of God, Tick," Gentle said. "This was my father. This was the unbeheld."
In a sudden fury he tore at Tick's hands, which were clamped to the man's face.
"Look, damn you! Look! I want to hear you tell me about the wonders, Tick. Go on. Tell me. Tell me!"
Tick didn't go back to the house when he and Gentle emerged from the passing place, but with some murmured words of apology headed off into the dusk, saying he needed to be on his home turf for a while and that he'd come back when he'd regained his composure. Sure enough, 3 days later he reappeared at number 28, still a little queasy, still a little shamefaced, to find that Gentle had not returned to his bed but was up and about. The reconciler's mood was brisk rather than blithe. His bed, he explained to Tick, was not the refuge it had previously been. As soon as he closed his eyes, he saw the slaughterhouse of the First in every atrocious detail, and could now only sleep when he'd driven himself to such exhaustion that there was no time between his head striking the pillow and oblivion for his mind to dwell on what he'd witnessed. Luckily, Tick had brought distractions, in the form of a party of 8 tourists, he preferred excursionists, from Vanayef, who were relying upon him to introduce them to the rites and rarities of the 5th Dominion. Before the tour began, however, they were eager to pay their respects to the great reconciler, and did so with a succession of painfully overworked speeches, which they read aloud before presenting Gentle with the gifts they'd brought, smoked meats, perfumes, a small picture of Padashokwa rendered in Zazai wings, a pamphlet of erotic poems by Pluthro Quexos's sister. The group was the first of many Tick brought in the next few weeks, freely admitting to Gentle that he was turning a handsome profit from his new role. "Have a holy day in the city of Sartori," was his pitch, and the more satisfied customers who returned to Vanayef with tales of eel pies and Jack the Ripper, the more who signed on to take the excursion. He knew the boom time couldn't last, of course. In a short while, the professional tour operators in Padashokwa would start trading, and he'd be unable to compete with their slick packages, except in one particular regard. Only he could guarantee an audience, however brief, with the Maestro Sartori himself. The time was coming, Gentle realized, when the 5th would have to face the fact that it was reconciled, whether it liked it or not. The first few sightseers from Vanayef and Padashokwa might be ignored, but when their families came, and their families' families, creatures in shapes, size, and assemblies that demanded attention, the people of this dominion would be able to overlook them no longer. It would not be long before Gamut Street became a sacred highway, with travellers passing down it in not one but both directions. When it did, living in the house would become untenable. He, Clem, and Monday would have to vacate number 28, and leave it to become a shrine. When that day arrived, and it would be soon, he would be forced to make a momentous decision. Should he seek out some sanctuary here in Britain, or leave the island for a country where none of his lives had ever taken him? Of one thing he was certain, he would not return to the 4th, or any dominion beyond it. Though it was true that he'd never seen Padashokwa, There had only ever been one soul he'd wanted to see it with, and that soul was gone.
2. Times were no less strange or demanding for Jude. She decided to leave the company in Gamut Street on the spur of the moment, expecting that she'd return there in due course. But the longer she stayed away, the harder it became to return. She hadn't realized, until Sartori was gone, how much she'd mourn. Whatever the source of the feelings she had for him, she felt no regrets. All she felt was loss. Night after night she'd wake up in the little flat she and Hoi Polloi had rented together. The old place was too full of memories, shaken to tears by the same terrible dream. She was climbing those damn stairs in Gamut Street, trying to reach Sartori as he lay burning at the top, but for all her toil, never managing to advance a single step. And always the same words on her lips when Hoi Polloi woke her.
"Stay with me! Stay with me!"
Though he'd gone forever, and she would have to make her peace with that eventually, he'd left a living keepsake, and as the autumn months came it began to make its presence felt in no uncertain fashion, its kicking keeping her awake when the nightmares didn't. She didn't like the way she looked in the mirror, her stomach a glossy dome, her breasts swelling and tender. But Hoi Polloi was there to lend comfort and companionship whenever it was needed. She was all Jude could have asked for during those months. Loyal, practical, and eager to learn. Though the customs of the Fifth were a mystery to her at first, she soon became familiar with its eccentricities and even fond of them. This was not, however, a situation that could continue indefinitely. If they stayed in the Fifth, and Jude had the child there, what could she promise it? A rearing and an education in a dominion that might come to appreciate the miracles in its midst some distant day, but would in the meantime ignore or reject whatever extraordinary qualities the child was blessed with. By the middle of October she'd made up her mind. She'd leave the Fifth, with or without Hoi Polloi, and find some country in the Imagica where the child, whether it was a prophetic, a melancholic, or simply priapic, would be allowed to flourish. In order to take that journey, of course, she would have to return to Gamut Street or its environs, and though that was not a particularly attractive prospect, it was better to do so soon, she reasoned, before many more sleepless nights took their toll and she felt too weak. She shared her plans with Hoi Polloi, who declared herself happy to go wherever Jude wished to lead. They made swift preparations and 4 days later left the flat for the last time, with a small collection of valuables to pawn when they got to the Fourth. The evening was cold, and the moon, when it rose, had a misty halo. By its light, the thoroughfares around Gamut Street were iridescent with the first etchings of frost. At Jude's request, they went first to Shiverick Square, so that she could pay her last respects to Sartori. Both his grave and those of the Oviats had been well disguised by Munday and Clem, and it took her quite a while to find the place where he was buried, but find it she did, and spent 20 minutes there while Hoi Polloi waited at the railings. Though there were revenants in the nearby streets, she knew he would never join their ranks. He'd not been born, but made, the stuff of his life stolen. The only existence he had after his decease was in her memory, and in the child. She didn't weep for that fact, or even for his absence. She'd done all she could, weeping and begging him to stay, but she did tell the earth that she'd loved what it was heaped upon, and charged it to give Sartori comfort in his dreamless sleep. Then she quit the graveside, and together she and Hoi Polloi went looking for the passing place into the Fourth. It would be day there, bright day, and she'd call herself by another name. Number 28 was noisy that night. The cause a celebration in honour of Irish, who'd that afternoon been released from prison, having served a 3-month sentence for petty theft, and had arrived on the doorstep, with Carol, Benedict, and several cases of stolen whiskey, to toast his release. The house was by now a trove of treasures, all gifts to the maestro from Tick Raw's excursionists, and there was no end to the drunken fooling these artifacts, many of them total enigmas, inspired. Gentle was feeling as facetious as Irish, if not more so. After so many weeks of abstinence, the substantial amounts of whiskey he'd imbibed had his head spinning, and he resisted Clem's attempts to engage him in serious conversation, despite the latter's insistence that the matter was urgent.
Only after some persuading did he follow Clem to a quieter place in the house, where his angels told him that Judith was in the vicinity. He was somewhat sobered by the news.
"Is she coming here?"
he asked.
"I don't think so,"
Clem said, his tongue passing back and forth over his lips as though her taste was upon them.
"But she's close."
Gentle didn't need further prompting. With Monday in tow, he went out into the street. There were no living creatures in sight, only the revenants. Listless as ever, their joylessness made all the more apparent by the sound of merrymaking that emanated from the house.
"I don't see her," Gentle said to Clem, who had followed them out as far as the step. "Are you sure she's here?"
It was Tay who replied.
"You think I wouldn't know when Judy was near?" "Of course I'm certain." "Which direction?"
Monday wanted to know. Now Clem again, cautioning. "Perhaps she doesn't want to see us."
"Well, I want to see her," Gentle replied. "At least a drink, for old time's sake." "Which direction, Tay?"
The angels pointed and Gentle headed off down the street, with Monday, bottle in hand, close on his heels. The fog that led on to the fourth looked inviting. A slow wave of pale mist that turned and turned on itself but never broke. Before she and Hoi Polloi stepped into it, Jude took a few moments to look up. The plough was overhead. She wouldn't be seeing it again. Then she said,
"That's enough, goodbyes."
And together they took a step into the mist. As they did so, Jude heard the sound of running feet in the alleyway behind them, and Gentle calling her name. She'd been aware that their presence might be detected and had schooled them both in how best to respond. Neither woman turned. They simply picked up their pace and headed on through the mist. It thickened as they went, but after a dozen steps, daylight began to filter through from the other side, and the fog's clammy cold gave way to balm. Again Gentle called after her, but there was a commotion up ahead, and it all but drowned out his call. Back in the fifth, Gentle came to a halt at the edge of the fog. He'd sworn to himself that he'd never leave the Dominion again, but the drink swilling in his system had weakened his resolve. His feet itched to go after her into the fog.
"Well, boss," Monday said, "are we going or aren't we?"
"Do you care either way?"
"Yes, as it happens."
"You'd still like to get your hands on Hoi Polloi, huh?"
"I dream about her, boss. Cross-eyed girls every night."
"Oh, well," Gentle said, "if we're chasing dreams, then I think that's good reason to go."
"Yeah?"
"In fact, it's the only reason."
He grabbed hold of Monday's bottle and took a healthy swig from it.
"Let's do it," he said,
and together they plunged into the fog, running over ground that softened and brightened as they went, paving stones becoming sand, night becoming day. They caught sight of the women, briefly, grey silhouettes against the peacock sky ahead, then lost them again as they gave chase. The gleam of the day grew, however, and so did the sound of voices, which rose to the din of an excited crowd as they emerged from the passing place. There were buyers, sellers, and thieves on every side, and disappearing into the throng, the women. They followed with renewed fervour, but the tide of people conspired to keep them from their quarry, and after half an hour of fruitless pursuit, which finally brought them back to the fog and the commercial hubbub which surrounded it, they had to admit that they'd been outmanoeuvred. Gentle was tetchy now, his head no longer buzzing but aching.
"They're away," he said. "Let's give up on it."
"Shit!
People come, people go. You can't afford to get attached to anyone."
"It's too late," Monday said dolefully. "I am."
Gentle squinted at the fog, his lips pursed. It was a cold October on the other side.
"I tell you what," he said after a little time, "we'll wander over to Vanayuff and see if we can find Tick Raw. Maybe he can help us."
Monday beamed.
"You're a hero, boss. Lead the way."
Gentle went on tiptoe, attempting to orient himself.
"Trouble is, I haven't a bloody clue where Vanayuff is," he said.
He collared the nearest passer-by and asked him how to get to the mount. The fellow pointed over the heads of the crowd, leaving the boss and his boy to burrow their way to the edge of the market, where they had a view not of Vanayuff, but of the walled city that stood between them and the Mount of Lipabayak. The grin reappeared on Monday's face, broader than ever, and on his lips the name he'd so often breathed like an enchantment.
Padashokwa?
Yes.
We painted it on the wall together. Do you remember?
I remember.
What's it like inside?
Gentle was peering at the bottle in his hand, wondering if the peculiar exhilaration he felt was going to pass with the headache that accompanied it.
Boss?
What?
I said, what's it like inside?
I don't know. I've never been.
Well, shouldn't we?
Gentle thrust the bottle at Monday and sighed a lazy, easy sigh that ended in a smile.
Yes, my friend, he said. I think maybe we should.
3. Thus began the last pilgrimage of the Maestro Sartori, called John Fury Zacharias, or Gentle, the Reconciler of Dominions, across the Imagica. He hadn't intended it to be a pilgrimage at all, but having promised Monday that they would find the woman of his dreams, he couldn't bring himself to desert the boy and return to the Fifth. They began their search, of course, in Padashokwa, which was more prosperous than ever these days, with its proximity to the newly reconciled Dominion creating businesses every day. After almost a year of wondering what the city would be like, Gentle was inevitably somewhat disappointed once he got inside its walls. But Monday's enthusiasm was a sight in itself, and a poignant reminder of his own astonishment when he and Pi had first entered the Fourth. Unable to trace the women in the city, they went on to Vaniev, hoping to find Tick. He was off travelling, they were told, but one sharp-sighted individual claimed to have seen two women who fitted the description of Jude and Hoi Polloi hitching a ride at the edge of the highway. An hour later, Gentle and Monday were doing the same thing, and the pursuit that was to take them across the Dominions began in earnest. For the Maestro, the journey was very different from those that had preceded it. The first time he'd made this trek, he'd travelled in ignorance of himself, failing to comprehend the significance of the people he'd met and the places he'd seen. The second time he'd been a phantom, flying at the speed of thought between members of the Synod, his business too urgent to allow him to appreciate the myriad wonders he was passing through. But now, finally, he had both the time and the comprehension to make sense of his pilgrimage, and having begun the journey reluctantly, he soon had as much taste for it as his companion. Word of the changes in his Ordorex had spread even to the tiniest villages, and the demise of the Autarch's empire was everywhere cause for jubilation. Rumours of the Imagica's healing had also spread, and when Monday told people where he and his quiet companion came from, which he was wont to do at the vaguest cue, they were plied with drinks and grilled for news of the paradisiacal Fifth. Many of their questioners, knowing that the door into that mystery finally stood open, were planning to visit the Fifth, and wanted to know what gifts they should take with them into a dominion that was already so full of marvels. When this question was put, Gentle, who usually let Monday do the talking during these interviews, invariably spoke up. "Take your family histories," he'd say. "Take your poems. Take your jokes. Take your lullabies. Make them understand in the Fifth what glories there are here." People tended to look at him askance when he answered in this fashion, and told him that their jokes and their family histories didn't seem particularly glorious. Gentle would simply say, "They are you, and you're the best gift the Fifth could be given."
"You know, we could have made a fortune if we brought a few maps of England with us," Monday remarked one day.
"Do we care about fortunes?" Gentle said.
"You might not, boss," Monday replied. "Personally, I'm much in favour."
He was right, Gentle thought. They could have sold 1,000 maps already, and they were only just entering the Third. Maps which would have been copied and the copies copied, each transcriber inevitably adding their own felicities to the design. The thought of such proliferation led Gentle back to his own hand, which had seldom worked for any purpose other than profit, and which, for all its labour, had never produced anything of lasting value. But unlike the paintings he'd forged, maps weren't cursed by the notion of a definitive original. They grew in the copying, as their inaccuracies were corrected, their empty spaces filled, their legends redevised. And even when all the corrections had been made, to the finest detail, they could still never be cursed with the word finished,
because their subject continued to change. Rivers widened and meandered, or dried up altogether. Islands rose and sank again. Even mountains moved. By their very nature, maps were always works in progress, and Gentle, his resolve strengthened by thinking of them that way, decided after many months of delay to turn his hand to making one. Occasionally, along the road, they'd meet an individual who, in ignorance of his audience, would boast some association with the Fifth's most celebrated son, the Maestro Sartori, and would proceed to tell Gentle and Monday about the great man. The accounts varied, especially when it came to talk of his companion. Some said he'd had a beautiful woman at his side, some his brother, called Pi, others still, these the least numerous, told of a mischief. At first it was all Monday could do not to blurt the truth, but Gentle had insisted from the outset that he wanted to travel incognito, and having been sworn to secrecy, the boy was as good as his word. He kept his silence, while wild tales of the maestro's doings were told, marriages celebrated on the ceiling, copses springing up overnight where he'd slept, women made pregnant drinking from his cup. The fact that he'd become a figment of the popular imagination amused Gentle at first, but after a time it began to weigh on him. He felt like a ghost among these living versions of himself, invisible among the listeners who gathered to hear tales of his exploits, the details of which were embroidered and embellished with every telling. There was some comfort in the fact that he was not the only character around whom such parables occurred. There were other fables alive in the air between the ears and tongues of the populace, which the pilgrims were usually told when they asked after Jude and Hoi Polloi, tales of miraculous women. A whole new nomadic tribe had appeared in the dominions since the fall of his Orderex. Women of power were abroad, rising to the occasion of their liberation, and rites they'd only practiced at the hearth and cot were now performed in the open air for all to see. But unlike the stories of the Maestro Sartori, most of which were pure invention, Gentle and Monday saw ample evidence that the stories concerning these women were rooted in truth. In the province around Maikeh, for instance, which had been a dust bowl during Gentle's first pilgrimage, they found fields green with the first crop in 6 seasons, courtesy of a woman who'd sniffed out the course of an underground river and coaxed it to the surface with sways and supplications. In the temples of Limbi, a sibyl had carved from a solid slab, using only her finger and her spittle, a representation of the city as she prophesied it would be in a year's time. Her prophecy so mesmeric that her audience had gone out of the temple that very hour and had torn down the trash that had disfigured their city. In the Quem, where Gentle took Monday in the hope of finding Scopeek, they found instead that the once shallow pit where the pivot had stood was now a lake, its waters crystalline, but its bottom hidden by the congregation of life that was forming in it, birds mostly, which rose in sudden, excited flocks, fully feathered and ready for the sky. Here they had a chance to meet the miracle worker, for the woman who'd made these waters, literally, her acolytes said, it was the pissing of a single night, had taken up residence in the blackened husk of the Quem Palace. In the hope of gleaning some clue to Jude and Hoi Polloi's whereabouts, Gentle ventured into the shadows to find the lake maker, and though she refused to show herself, she answered his inquiry. No, she hadn't seen a pair of travellers, such as he described. But yes, she could tell him where they'd gone. There were only 2 directions for wandering women these days, she explained. Out of his order X and into it. He thanked her for this information and asked her if there was anything he could do for her in return. She told him that there was nothing she wanted from him personally, but she'd be very glad of the company of his boy for an hour or two. Somewhat chagrined, Gentle went